And so they have all of these good sayings that we would like to do this, we would like to do that, we would like to raise eligibility standards. But in fact, they don't want to do it at their own institution, and they have something which I call presidential admits into the university. Every major university in America, including Stanford out in your area, Penn State here, Alabama, Auburn, all of them allow presidential admits, people that couldn't ordinarily get into their institution, but they need them for especially basketball and football. And so at Stanford, for instance, there might be a 300-point difference between the average student body and the average SAT score of their football and basketball players. And that's true whether it's Notre Dame or Stanford or Penn State. There's a huge difference. So you ask the question, can the NCAA reform intercollegiate athletics? Maybe, maybe not. But if it gets really bad, where you're going to find the reform of intercollegiate athletics is either by the federal legislature, Congress, or by the courts. And the courts, as you may know, reformed intercollegiate sports for women by the passage of Title IX in 1972. And legislation has come on various things, including civil rights and allowing blacks to come into sports as well as other blacks coming into other areas of higher education. So courts and the legislature may be the best place for reform if the presidents and the NCAA choose not to do it.
By the way, I agree with you with your analysis of the fact that they want to see reform, but they don't want to do it at their own school. But I also think, and if I'm wrong, correct me on this, that I think that they're in conflict. Because while these presidents, and I've said this on the air, and it may not be fair, I said they don't know if the ball's stuffed or blown up, while they talk about reform and doing these sort of things, they also want to be able to get money from their alums, not only for their athletic programs, but for the university overall. And if somebody tried to reform college athletics or even their own school, and the school went from being a team that won 10 or 11 games and went to a bowl and had a shot at the national championship, but because they did and didn't get the same caliber of athlete, that all of a sudden they dropped down to being a, say, a 6-6 team, no university president would do that. The other thing is that I found that these university presidents love flying on the people who give them the money, their corporate jets going off and watching their football team play somewhere around the country.
I think you have it absolutely correct, Ron. That is a major problem. The presidents are caught in between commercialism, which they need to run the program and to satisfy those alumni and other people in their community, for instance, states or at Notre Dame, maybe the Catholic religion. They're caught in between the commercialism and then having athletes be really students. And I think you have it right.
Are the presidents, and you know, and I don't want to come down too hard on them, but I don't think they're equipped, as I said, to deal in the commercial world of big-time college athletics. I mean, are they not pimping out their sports if they allow, say, their football game to be moved to 11 o'clock in the morning because it's going to be televised by ESPN or any of the other broadcast networks? I mean, if you give in on things like that because it's money that's coming in, I don't see where you can have any moral backbone to be able to make the tough decisions.
And I think you have it right there. ESPN was terrific for the commercialization of college and other sports. But ESPN has and would do it every minute of the day, all days of the week, if they could. And they are moving in that direction so that there are basketball games televised every night of the week, many afternoons during the week. And they would love to move football games to all days of the week and are essentially doing that, especially of the second rank of the big-time schools. If you notice, those are the ones that get on Thursday night football, the second-rate schools that don't get the image, like a Notre Dame that can get on almost any time, or or a Penn State or Alabama or this year Auburn. So I think you're right that they are caught in between commercialism and doing what they know is right. And that's the problem that we have. That's why it may not be that presidents really can reform intercollegiate athletics.
Is this a dangerous precedent with the University of Texas having their own television network and, of course, Notre Dame having their network and everything?
I just think it's in addition to the commercialism that we've seen. You probably know that the Big Ten was the first one to have its own network, and that because it's been so successful financially, bringing in millions of dollars to every school. Even the institution that I went to in the Big Ten, Northwestern, which is on the lowest level of bringing in money, it does very well by the Big Ten network. And the SEC will do the same, and Texas knows that it is the most important school in Texas with great football tradition, and it can have its own network, and it will do very well with that network, and so it just raises the bar for commercialism.
We've talked about the problems. Let's talk about the possible solutions to some of these problems. As you researched this, Ronald, and saw what these problems are, I don't know whether you felt that the problems are so entrenched that there isn't an answer. What do you see if you had to crystal ball the effort to reform college athletics and where we're headed?
Well, my crystal ball is one in which about the only time you have major reform is when a crisis occurs. And right at the present time, there's no crisis that seems to be so great that it would bring about unbelievable reform. I end my book on one reform that could have some impact, and that's going back to an old rule that we had for six decades of the 20th century, and that is the rule called the freshman rule, in which freshmen are not eligible. I think this would have a great impact on whether students are coming to the university to get an education. Right now, especially in basketball, the players come in who are really good for 1 year because the pros say you need to be 19 before you can go pro. They play 1 year, and then they go pro. And universities like Kentucky and Louisville are very good at this. And there are a number of others that bring in freshmen knowing they're only going to play 1 year, go pro, and I think the freshman rule would be one major start, and we had that from the early 1900s until the late 1960s, when for financial reasons they voted the freshman rule out and allowed freshmen to play in all the sports except football and basketball, and then 4 years later allowed football and basketball players to go play their first year.
You know, as well as I do, the NBA has the rule that you have to play at least 1 year, or at least be out of your high school sport 1 year, or play 1 year at college before you can make yourself eligible for the NBA. And I'm just wondering whether the pro leagues would then just step in and just siphon off the talent that might go on to college.
I think it'd be wonderful. I don't think it would have much of an impact on college sport. There would be, six or eight players who can go pro immediately from high school, maybe less than that, like a Bryant did with Los Angeles. But there aren't many of those players. And if a person wanted to play immediately at the college level, and couldn't the freshman year, they'd go play in France or Italy or someplace for a year and then go into the pros if they were good enough in NBA, if they were a star over there. I don't think that would have any major impact on the colleges at all. We'd just miss one or two or three really major players. But they only stay here 1 year anyway.
It does seem to me, and you touched on this, and I think you're absolutely right, if there is going to become legitimate reform in college athletics, it's going to have to come from people outside of college athletics, which is namely either the courts or Congress. But then I think most people would ask you, first of all, should Congress even be involved in something like this? And are they any better equipped than the presidents are? Because I'm not sure some of our politicians know whether the ball's stuffed or blown up there either. And the courts would look at it just purely from, a very clinical approach, and whether that would be good as well.
Well, what the courts will do if they do something is to say college sports are no longer amateur. They are professional, and therefore we are going to tax them, and we are going to tax workers' compensation, and that will have a major impact on the financial well-being of college sport. And when the courts come in and say you are no longer amateur, you're going to find some major changes occurring in college sports. That's why the universities ought to take it upon themselves to reform before Congress does.
Well, exactly, because nobody likes to have the threat of either the courts or the Congress coming in and telling them what to do.
That is right, and I can remember Bill Bradley, the All-American, the Rhodes Scholar and politician who tried to reform athletics along with several other congressmen 20 years or so ago, and they had a little bit of impact, but they could have, but it's really a crisis is going to have to occur, I think. And I don't think Cam Newton's father trying to bribe schools to give him money so that his son would go to that school, I don't think that's going to be the crisis that does it.
What do you think will be the crisis that does do it then, as you see the landscape of college athletics today?
Probably it could be something that would trigger like a gambling scandal like they had in 1951 or 1961 or at Boston College in the 1970s. That kind of a crisis could swing things around. And the major crisis that has changed college sport, strangely, is the one in 1905 over football brutality. And that's right after that we had the forward pass legislated by the NCAA. That was a major, major reform to try to break the brutality that was in college sport at the time, with several deaths every year and many, many major injuries.
Ron, without aside from you with a book like this, Pay for Play, are there any other sane voices out there trying to be heard?
Sane voices. Depends upon what you consider sanity. There are a fair number of reformers, but they usually are so radical that no one's going to take them seriously. And the radical ones want to do away with big-time college sport. That's not going to happen. And it's not going to happen with federal legislation or the courts. It's still going to be there. But there are ways of trying to make the athletes who are in college also be students. And you can't do something like the University of Michigan has done, which is to set up a complete area of study for their football players. 85% of their football players are in one curriculum. That is absolutely crazy, and it should be that should be known. And if that keeps occurring, that could be the trigger that Congress would come in and say, look, we can't have that. We can't set up a curriculum so the football players can remain eligible. It's wrong. And it shouldn't be done, but it's done in a lot of institutions.
Let me ask you this question then. If you take a look at the NCAA, and while they do have a president of the NCAA, it's still the power lies in the hands of the presidents and the chancellors and everything. But if you look at professional sports and the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell, you look at David Stern in the NBA, and you look at how successful those leagues have been, how disciplined those leagues have been, could somebody come in, or should somebody come in and be the head of college athletics that then would give them the focal power to be able to do these reforms instead of having to be put up to a vote and having all these chefs stirring the stew?
I don't think you're going to have that kind of a person come in. One, the universities would not allow it in the first place.
And it makes too much sense.
And it may or may not make sense. Certainly it wouldn't make sense to the presidents. Most presidents have fairly big egos. and or they couldn't become president of an institution. And they are not going to allow someone from the outside come in to do this.
Professor Ronald Smith, and you can be sure the controversy and discussion on reforming college athletics will continue. Finally, we spend time with a boxing champion and also a man who helped athletes cheat. The boxing champion, Nonito Donaire, and the man who helped athletes cheat is Victor Conti. Donaire is a clean athlete who is a Filipino-American boxer who holds the WBC and WBO Bantamweight World Championship and has won 5 world titles in 3 different boxing weight classes. He went to the same school in the Philippines as champion Manny Pacquiao. Victor Conti did jail time for his role in the Balco performance-enhancing drug scandal that involved athletes in football, baseball, track, and field. Some of the biggest names in sports used his illegal products. He now wants to clean up sports and be a crusader for fair and clean competition. He's back in sports helping Donaire in boxing and Marlon Byrd of the Cubs in baseball. Recently, he and Donaire were the focus of an HBO Real Sports piece. So I started by asking Conti what was his motivation and reason for doing the HBO piece.
Well, originally, a piece was done by the Los Angeles Times in December of 2009 after I'd been working with Andre Ward, and he won the championship against Kessler. And I guess HBO saw that and reached out to me shortly thereafter. And it took about a year for the whole thing to develop. I went to New York and met with one of the producers back there. And then once they learned about me working with Marlon Byrd, the Major League Baseball All-Star, as well as Nonito Donaire, they reached out and asked if they could send a film crew and follow us around for a day and do some one-on-one interviews with myself and Marlon and Nonito, and that's exactly what occurred.
One of the things I always ask athletes, and I think it's appropriate to talk to you about this, is have you had a chance to kind of sit back and reflect on the what you went through, what you did, and where you want to go from here?
Absolutely. That started from the very beginning, right after the infamous Balco raid in September of 2003. And, I obviously knew that what I had done was wrong. It was all wrong, and many people were damaged and harmed by these very poor decisions that I made to take that trip down the slippery slope and join the culture of using performance-enhancing drugs. And so I feel very blessed and fortunate and glad that there are people like Nonito in the world that can find forgiveness in their hearts and allow me an opportunity to work with elite athletes again.
Yeah, and, I was interested because, I've talked to you a number of times, and I've always found you very honest, very open about things, and yet I'm wondering whether you ever understood why you decided to go the direction you went before you got to this particular point. And I think I understand why, and if I'm wrong about this, correct me. I remember in our interview right after everything came down, you said to me that you always had the driving force to see an athlete get the most out of themselves. And I don't think that you necessarily thought what you were doing was wrong. You knew it probably was breaking the rules of the game, but that you were kind of almost testing, in a sense, to find out how good an athlete could be. Am I correct in that observation?
The challenge was a part of it, no question. I think what really made me finally make the decision to join the culture, and a lot of people don't understand that I started working with world-class athletes in 1984, and I'd work with Super Bowl teams, the Denver Broncos, when they won back-to-back Super Bowls in 97, 98. I'd worked with Alberto Salazar, who was a world record holder in the 80s in the marathon, Matt Biondi, who was the world's fastest swimmer in the 80s. And I learned in 1992, in fact, it was with a guy that my first interview with you 23 years ago here, Greg Trefalis, actually at the national championships, track and field championships in New Orleans in 1992, he tested positive for Dianabol. And I had heard from an Olympic official that I'd become fairly close with that there were some positive drug tests in 1988 at the Olympic Games. But after this positive test at the track and field championships in 1992, and this gentleman called me and told me that, your boy tested positive, meaning Greg, and of course I talked to him about it, I didn't have anything to do with giving any of these athletes performance-enhancing drugs until 2000, so this was 8 years before that. But later, he called back 4 or 5 days later, and he said, listen, you can tell your boy that he's off the hook. A group of the elder statesmen have decided that they're going to cover up these positive drug tests and sweep them under the rug. Once I had that knowledge directly from an Olympic official that this is what happens at the highest level of sport, that those who control the majority of the financial gain are the ones that make these sorts of decisions, it was a number of years before I actually was introduced to Patrick Arnold, who had the original CLEAR, as I named it, but it was something that he'd gotten out of the Merck Index called Norbolethone, and it was undetectable, and I knew it was undetectable, and I made that decision to join the culture. It was a very bad decision, but the logic that I used or rationale that I used was that I'd become very close with these athletes. I knew their wives. I knew their kids, and I knew that they had life after sport, and because I owned a fully licensed clinical laboratory, we could do the testing on cholesterol fractions and liver function and kidney function. And my rationale was that I could help them do what they were already doing, but in a more safe and effective manner. And it was a bad decision. It was just, I'm just trying to lead you through, you know, my thinking process, and it was certainly wrong. And if I could do it all over again, I would have never made that decision.
I certainly know that frustration is a motivating factor in everybody's life to some degree. And I'm just wondering whether the frustration has been transferred because after all of this came down, I remember you sitting here in the studio and telling me that you wanted to help kind of clean up sports and everything. And you have tried. There has been no doubt. And I saw in the HBO Real piece where you've just been pushed aside, where somebody with the experience that you have, they've not taken advantage of it. Why do you think that is?
That's a very good question, and you're right. I've reached out and met with both USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency, as well as WADA. And in fact, I've been working on a recent project with them involving a designer substance. And at a certain point, I told Dick Pound, who was the founder and chairman of WADA, that he should go back and take a look at the notes. I flew to New York at their expense December the 12th of 2007, and I sat down with Dick in a conference room together with another lawyer who was the scriber, and they scribed 3.5 hours of our discussion. Long story short, when I asked him to go back and look at those notes to verify that what I told him 3 or 4 years ago, I was now, in essence, proving that what I was saying was true, he got back to me and said, "Well, I'm sorry to tell you, but the notes from your meeting have been destroyed." So my deduction is they really don't want to know what's going on.
When people hear the name Victor Conti, what do you think their impression is today?
I'm hoping that it's changing, that now I can try to do what Nonito and other athletes do by inspiring other people, that, you know, that I do have the heart of a good person, and just because I've made all these mistakes and caused so much suffering and pain to so many people, that doesn't mean I have to give up, that I can continue to try to make a contribution and help other people.
Have you had an awakening about being able to work with Nonito and Marlon Byrd and seeing how they are able to perform, doing it the right way, the honest way? I mean, did the light come on and say to Victor Conti, why in the hell didn't I do this before this way?
Yes, most certainly. And really, that's something that I'm very, very, you know, grateful to Nonito and Marlon. And I can tell you here today that Nonito is as clean of an athlete he's just a great person in addition to being a great athlete. There's lots of very good athletes out there, but Nonito's also a terrific human being. And it takes a special person like him to be able to forgive someone and actually take on that cost or that burden of being associated with somebody like me.
How bad is cheating with performance-enhancing substances today in your mind?
I think that it is less than it was pre-Balco raid in 2003. And at the elite level then, it may have been 80%, would be a rough guess on my part. And it may be down to 50, 60% now, but I still believe it's a majority.
Across the board in all sports?
Across the board in all sports. It's worse in some sports than others. As an example, Tour de France riders, I still believe that it's 100%. But in other sports, it's less. And the testing has been effective. But that's the great part of this entire story that I think was being told on HBO Real Sports. Nonito is 100% clean. He does everything the right way. And he is a multiple-time world champion. And as he said recently, I believe this is only the beginning for Nonito.
And I don't believe that it'll ever get under control. I think the genie is out of the bottle here. Athletes are always going to do whatever it takes because the rewards of being victorious probably overwhelm the thoughts of defeat.
And, you know, living with that, you know, knowing that you didn't do it the right way. I think that the athlete cheats themselves out of that satisfaction, how sweet it is to know that you've done it the right way. I think that's something that an athlete like Nonito and Marlon have that others that known that they've been down that slippery slope and they've got, there's a deep, dark secret there. I think it makes it much more gratifying to someone that's put in all that hard work.
Nonito Donaire is with us in the studio, Filipino-American professional boxer, and I tell you what, watching this young man in the ring, just the way he moves, you can almost tell, you know, people that are special in a particular sport. I know over the years that I've been doing play-by-play, there were people like John Elway, and there were people, other people in other sports that I saw that you just knew that they were going to be something special, and this young man is very, very special. You know, I mentioned to you that, you know, you went to the same school in the Philippines as Manny Pacquiao. That, to me, what was it like growing up having gone to that same school? What did they talk about Manny Pacquiao?
Well, really nothing. I mean, at that time, Manny was really poor. I mean, I didn't know who he was, actually, until I met him in the United States. But, you know, to be in the same school my mom was teaching at and Manny went, I mean, it's crazy.
He is something certainly of a legend, not only in the Philippines, but around the world. What is it that makes him a great champion in your mind?
Well, not only that, he shows the humility and you know, the poverty, what he went through, that people, it's kind of like from rag to riches kind of thing, you know. But not only that, he explodes in that ring. He has defeated numerous champions, and he has proven himself to be the best. And you know, that's really what people can really capture. But aside from that, from Filipinos, they can relate to how he has grown and how he has become now, you know, a very well-respected person.
I think that there is a difference in the definition of a boxer slash fighter and a champion. I want to know what your perception and your definition of the word boxing champion is.
Well, boxing champion is proving yourself, fighting the best out there, you know, and just going through it without anything. I mean, just being who you are and defeating the guys that you know, that believe that supposedly are better than you, and you prove everybody wrong that, you know, you can defeat anybody as long as you put your mind into it. And that's what he is a boxing world champion.
And you are too as well. And I've always been interested in the mindset that makes somebody be able to go into the ring and do something very brutal, and then when they come out, be as nice as you are. You got to be able to throw that switch on. I think, you know,
it's so weird because this last fight, I mean, Fernando Montiel is a friend of mine, and as we went through the press conference, you know, we hug each other and we say each other, you know, good luck, and then, you know, you're a friend of mine, but this is just business. But once actually on the day of the weigh-ins, that's when everything just started switching, you know, as we went face off, you know, after the weigh-ins, I guess from being deprived of food and liquids and, you know, dehydrated. And when we look at each other, we know what we want to do in that ring, and that is to destroy each other or, you know, get the best of each other. And inside that ring, the switch just turns on fully, and you're ready to go.
That mind game in which you have to go from being an average person to being somebody angry, and angry is what you've got to be in the ring in order to do what you have to do. None of us probably could understand it. Give me some insight, Nonito, and what you do. What do you have to do with your mind to allow yourself to take care of business in the ring?
I don't see it as anger, actually. I see it as, I look at boxing as art. You know, whatever I put a game plan outside of that ring, I want to accomplish it and achieve it inside that ring. And that is very satisfying for me. But it's more of competitiveness. It's not anger. It's like playing basketball. You know, you want to run the best. You want to shoot right. You want to steal the ball. And you just give it all you got, you know. And it's kind of that feeling for me. I go in that ring and I want to hit him. I want to make him miss. I want to trap him with my style and take advantage of it. And that's how you really look at it. The only time I was really angry was at the Chinyan fight. And you know, I wanted him to get up more and just keep dropping him. You know, that was pretty much the only time I was really angry, where I didn't care about the championship, where I didn't care about anything but just hitting this guy. But usually the majority of my fights, especially with the Fernando Montiel, I look at it as art and as putting it as a game plan and achieving it in that sense. But there's really no hatred or anger in my part.
Well, I'm going to make an observation, and if I'm wrong about this, correct me, please. And that is, in watching you, and I've watched you in two fights, and I thought to myself, this is a young man, this is a champion that likes breaking down the art of boxing, that you love to take a look and say, he's doing this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to prepare for the fight in this way. You like the mental stimulation as much as you do the physical stimulation.
That is what that's what satisfies me more. Because, I mean, I plan on knocking everybody out. But if I don't accomplish that, that means I made a flaw in looking at my opponent, in analyzing the opponent's steps, punches, and position in body. And I'd look at that, like this last fight with Fernando Montiel. I looked at it where he's going to be, where his head is going to be, how he protects himself, where his defense is going to be, how he's going to attack, what's the first reaction when I scare him away, when I faint him, what's his first reaction? And that was a hook, you know, or his left side was mostly the dominant side on him. So, you know, I just pretty much break it down and see what I can be comfortable in taking a punch or in avoiding a punch or creating a situation where a fight can be over within a single punch.
You're a young fighter still developing, and I'm wondering if you're aware of the fact that you might get pulled into a trap. I heard you say you expect to knock everybody out. And, of course, that's a little bit like coming to the plate and saying, I'm going to hit a home run every time. And I remember Tony Gwynn, the Hall of Fame baseball player, said to me, he said, the mistake that most good hitters make is that they want to pull the ball. But if the ball's on the outside part of the plate, you just go with the ball and go the opposite way. Do you look at fights? Are you mature enough now in your fight capabilities, Nonito, to be able to say, wait a minute, maybe I can't knock this guy out, but I'm going to do whatever it takes to be able to win, if you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, with Montiel, I expected a chess match game, but if it went 12 rounds, 20 rounds, 50 rounds, I'm always willing. That's why I train hard with Victor and with Remy, you know, and all my guys, Michael Basil, my strength trainer, my ART guys, and my trainers, Jonathan and Robert Garcia, you know, we train really hard, like we're fighting for a full 12 rounds, but, you know, we just have the game plan to try to knock everybody out. And if it doesn't happen, we are, you know, educated enough or experienced enough to see how we can be victorious at the end of it all.
I want to ask you, in that Real Sports show that you were on and also Victor was on, they had a piece also on Mike Tyson as well. And one thing that was always said of Mike, among many things said about Mike Tyson, was that he was somebody that appreciated the history of boxing, that he understood the great champions and what they did. I'm going to ask you, you know, are you a historian? Do you appreciate kind of the history of the sport as well as some of the people that have been champions? I mean, have you studied up on them? Do you have your favorites along the way?
I'm an old school fighter. That's who I am. You know, the way I fight, the way I think, and the way I give myself in that ring, you know, I learned from the art of the old school fighting from Sugar Robinson, you know, from Muhammad Ali, and of course the guys, Sugar Leonard, Hagler, Hearns, Duran, all those guys, Salvador Sanchez, you know, Wilfredo Gomez. I mean, those guys, you know, Aguayo, I mean, you name it, you know, I enjoy those fights. Those fights were incredible, and those are the guys that I've learned from growing up. I mean, as well as, you know, from Trinidad De La Hoya and all those guys, Roy Jones, I've learned, but from the beginning, it was from the old school fights, and I still have that mentality of respecting and acknowledging the old school fights.
I anticipated your answer, and so you kind of set me up with the next question, Nonito, and that is the fact, what is the commonality that the great fighters, the truly great fighters that you mentioned, what do they all do well?
They fought each other. You know, these days, a lot of the guys tend to not fight each other, or guys who they feel like they could take advantage. Back then, they didn't care who it is. If the guy was on top, they'll fight the guys on top. You know, it was only one person who dominated it, or if another, then they were going to see who's better, you know. But the old school is just the heart. They have the heart of a champion. You know, they're willing and they're not afraid, you know. As much as they feel like the guy's going to be tough, you know, that doesn't scare them. Just the thought of being there and just being with the best guys and proving yourself better, and just giving it all. I mean, there's so many fights out there that you can tell, like Arguello and Pryor. I mean, they were going at it. Arguello was getting hit like crazy, or Salvador Sanchez and Wilfredo Gomez when he broke his cheekbones, and you know, he was really beaten up and he still kept going. I mean, that's the heart of a champion. I mean, you'll see it sometimes around here with the Mexican fighters and other guys, but it's not too often as it was back then.
Do you ever feel like you're going to be compared to Manny, and that are you trapped by his success and the way people look at him, particularly Filipinos?
Actually, I'm honored. I'm really honored to be, you know, to be on the same line as Manny Pacquiao. You know, that's what people don't understand, is that you're comparing me to the best fighter of this era. You're comparing me with the number one pound for pound. And for me, it's like I'm just honored and be blessed with the whole I think that's an achievement for me. You know, I'm just going to do the best that I can do. I mean, my guys feel like I'm the best of what I am, you know, and who I am. And you know, they always back me up. But, you know, that's what it is. I mean, I'm just honored to have just a wonderful blessing.
How did you two get together? Tell me, Nonito, how you came across him and how and why did you decide to work with Victor?
It's crazy. You know, I believe that it's kind of faith for me because of all places, we meet in the bank. You know, my guy, we were talking on, you know, and then we're talking about the fight and stuff like that. And Victor overheard us talking about the fight. So he's talking about the manager about the fight. And I just kind of stand back and like, oh, this guy knows a lot what he's talking about. But I didn't know who he was, you know, and he saw the van and, you know, he was asking his daughter who knew my strength trainer. And that's when we got together. And at first everybody was like, oh, you're signing yourself to the devil. Don't go there. Don't, you know. So, but I don't ever judge the book by its cover. You know, I just want to see how it was. And for me, I want to seek to be the best of what I can be. I mean, you know, and you know, it just happened. It was just one of those things.
What did you know about his background?
After I learned, you know, about the Balco stuff and all that stuff that they try to educate me with, you know, I was like, wow, this guy's a mad scientist, man. You know, But, you know, as I went and talked with Victor, that's when I found out, you know, this guy is genuine. This guy is really a nice guy. You know, and as I went to get to know him more, he not only became my friend, but now he become kind of like a father to me, because he has looked out for me throughout and for me the same way, because, you know, he's been great. Victor has been just an amazing person and just a big, big part of my success now. And I think he's one of the keys that God has brought me to be better.
Victor, is he the first athlete that you've been involved with since all of this Balco stuff came down? Was he the first one?
No, I've continued working with athletes, most of them, you know, more low profile. But,
yeah, that's what I was going to say.
I continued all through the Balco period, even up until, you know, right after the prison period that I spent with Dwayne Chambers, who was the European gold medalist at 60 meters in 2009. And then in 2010, he became the world champion indoors at 60 meters. So I've continued to work all the way through. I started with him in 2002. So I continued to work with Dwayne.
But he's the highest profile athlete as far as champion. I mean, somebody who's a boxing champion is somebody that's...
Well, I did work for a couple of fights, and actually it started long before, back in 2003, but I helped Andre Ward with his fight against Edison Miranda, and then I helped him before when he won the championship against Kessler. So Nonito actually contacted Andre and talked with him, you know, after we first met, and to try to get some feedback. And back to your earlier point with him, you know, I think above and beyond all of his other skills and talents, I think early in Nonito's career, he didn't make a lot of the decisions. And I think now that he has grown up and gotten married, he has a very, very smart wife, Rachel, who really helps him make decisions. But Nonito is now steering the boat, so to speak. He's the decision maker. And I just try to do things that bring more information to him about his training and the training load and what's required in terms of the recovery interval and nutrition. But ultimately, Nonito calls the shots. He really is truly an excellent decision maker, and he's got a great team of people around him, and he gets input from everybody. But bottom line is that he's the one that's calling the shots, and he's done a great job together with his wife that now that I've worked with him about the last 10 months or so, I've seen tremendous growth in both of them, and I'm very proud of them.
Nonito, I think it's kind of ironic. As I said, I've known Victor for a long time, but there is something about boxing that is that deals with redemption, does it not? I mean, there's a lot of guys that have gone to prison and come out and made careers and lives from the zelt. It's almost like boxing redeems people.
It's the wild, wild west.
I mean, do you see it that way in a sense? I mean, here is a man who, you know, was marked with the big C for cheating and everything, and all of a sudden he gets involved. He's been involved with other athletes, but obviously being involved with you, your success, you know, it certainly is redeeming for him. Do you see it that way as well?
I mean, it can be in any sports, I think, and for me, it just comes down to how a person is. You know, with me, I've known a lot of guys who came in and I want to be your nutritionist, I want to be your this and this and that, and it just never appealed to me because I felt like they were not talking from their heart. I feel like there was something behind it. You know, like Victor said before, you know, you can tell a man by two words, you said, Victor?
By the one of two questions. Either how can I help and how can I serve, or what's in it for me?
So, you know, it was more of Victor just wanted to see my potential. You know, Victor wanted to help me in seeing my potential. And I seek to be better. I seek to be stronger. And I tell Victor from the beginning, because I didn't know him in the beginning, I said, you know, I'm the cleanest guy. And if ever that anyone question me because I'm working with you, and I will tell them that I have a vein, you guys get a needle, check me 24/7 all year round. And, you know, and I'm not afraid for that. And from what I've gotten with Victor, I mean, Victor's just been incredible.
It's funny because I thought about this. I mean, you are a guy that has a reputation of being a clean guy. Why would anybody want to confuse their life? Why would anybody want to have to deal with the questions? Well, gee, if you're working with Victor Conti, something must not be right about this. Did that ever bother you? Did you not want to mess up your life and keep it simple by not having to deal with the questions about this man?
I seek to be the best. You know, I'm like Bruce Lee sometimes, I think, with that mentality. You know, I'm here to see the very best of what I can do, what God has given me physically, you know. And it just happened to be that Victor is one of the key to make me better, because I can feel the difference. I mean, the high altitude simulation that he introduced me with, you know, there's nothing that I'm taking. I'm taking air, but it's just tripping my whole system in gaining more blood cells, taking in the more oxygen and increasing the size of my blood cells, you know, and that's from Victor. You know, it's just, I'm not taking anything else, you know, but I mean, there's other things that I've taken to help me recover, you know, but that all comes down to the ultimate of having the blood test before the fight. And that's when the last fight, Victor called me Monster Man.
Yeah, by the way, don't ever get your picture taken again with that mask on. It is God ugly. Victor, I asked Nonito about how close he was to his full potential, and he said 80%. What does what you're doing with him, the nutrition aspect, what does that do to help him reach that 100% or even the 80% he's at right now?
I think I'm helping him make more informed decisions.
About what?
About the necessary recovery interval that's required. A lot of athletes train very hard in 6 days a week, and they overtrain. And a lot of the Department of Military Medicine data shows that it suppresses your immune system, and you can ultimately become sick from training so much. And I think Nonito trains harder when he trains. On the days he trains, he brings 110%, but he trains less days.
So you're teaching him to be smarter.
I'm trying to teach him to be smarter. That's exactly what
correct.
I'm trying to do, that more is less, because if you train 6 days a week and you're not 100% and you're only bringing 80% 6 days a week, as opposed to training, say, 4 days a week and bringing 110%, when you really improve your performance, when the tissue repair and the healing occurs and the performance gains come, is when you're resting. So he's wearing a monitor that tells him all sorts of different things that helps him. We look at the data up on a big screen in the conference room after sessions, and he will make a decision that, hey, tomorrow's I'm going to sleep in. I'm going to take a nap. Tomorrow's going to be a rest day.
Nonito Donaire showing the skill and talent can make you a winner and champion, and Victor Conti admitting the error of his ways and wanting to help make sure all athletes compete on an even playing field. I hope you've enjoyed U.S. Airways' in-flight presentation of Sports Byline USA, and you'll listen to our live broadcast on radio, the American Forces Network worldwide, Sirius XM satellite radio, and the Internet. And if you'd like a listing of Sports Byline USA's radio affiliates, be sure to check our award-winning website. You'll find that at sportsbyline.com. I'm Ron Barr, and thanks for being a part of America's sports talk show, Sports Byline USA.